there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll on 3191.
Bellman?
Aye.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Dunn?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye.
Dix?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Any volunteers? Rep. St. Burton, carry the bill. Okay, 3030.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
3191, I would suggest that Representative Burton have staff available. I foresee that that could create some questions when we talk about expanded record.
Staff is so instructed.
Some of our more liberal members of our body.
You can handle it.
I might note, I think it was noted in the subcommittee that the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association had some serious concerns about that. They thought that this ought to remain a part of the record.
And that
alone is enough to make you want to vote for it.
Seriously, if staff has, if they can review the records, it would help in our times. If there was a couple of examples that could be given for the staff measure analysis.
Okay. We'll ask our counsel to do that.
3030, Representative Hanlon.
Representative Dix.
Representative Dix.
3030. Most of you have a hand in gross version of 3030. It's a very large document that's in front of you. And perhaps, rather than my going through the different sections of the bill, it would be easier if members of the committee had questions. I would be happy to address those, or if the chair wishes me to, I can go through the bill page by page.
Why don't you go ahead and place the motion, Representative Dix, and then we'll see what kind of discussion.
I would move House Bill 3030 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, and that includes amendments considered in
with as amended in subcommittee.
Okay, Representative Dix moves House Bill 3030 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Just to point out that what we're talking about in the area in 3030 is the area of the law related to domestic relations and how the court administers those cases. And there are numerous issues touched on in this bill, as Representative Dix referred to.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon, have you concluded your comments?
Yeah.
Representative Bellamy.
Mr. Chair, I have three things that I would like to bring up. One on two of them on page 17, and I want you to know that I 17 on the big copy.
The big copy.
I asked after the subcommittee, and I voted no in subcommittee simply because there's a lot of changes in this bill, and I wanted to review, and I asked Judge Behrens to review this bill. He reviewed it very quickly and called me on the phone and gave me, and I tried to take in my shorthand his comments. Most of his comments, he didn't understand the hand and grossing of the bill, but there are three areas left that I would like to bring up. On page 17, I would move to, and I don't have lines, so it'd be subparagraph 6, and it's part that's underlined. It starts with if a party. I would move to amend by striking out the word all.
Okay, let's make sure we know where we're at here.
Page 17, the top of the page would be, that party will pay all attorney's fees. I'm moving to amend by striking out the word all.
Okay. Representative Bellamy moves on page 17 of the
Hand and Gross.
Hand and Gross, which is the bed sheet bill here. Well, it's not quite like a bed sheet ballot, but it's...
No.
I don't know if it's queen size or king size, but anyway. Okay, on the top of the page 17, at what appears to be line 4, Representative Bellamy's moved to delete the word all. Representative Bellamy, to your motion.
Question of the judge was, and you've got to you realize here that we're talking about a party who has acted in bad faith, if you read the line, and I understand that. His concern was is that the court would have to award attorney's fees no matter what they were. And I believe you would take care of that if you just remove the word all. What we're saying is that the court can award attorney's fees. His point being is that in some of these cases, you can have an extraordinary amount of attorney's fees that may or may not be justified as to the case. I looked at it just now and thought removing the word all would probably solve that problem.
Representative Dix?
Perhaps counsel can tell me the effect of that, what that would do.
Well, I guess what Representative, or correct me if I'm wrong, is what you're getting at. I mean, if the attorney fees were inordinately high, I think language that we sometimes see in reference to attorney's fees is reasonable attorney fees. That's just kind of off the top of my head. Is that what you're trying to get at? That they should pay the attorney fees of this other party, but you want to clarify that it can't just be some outrageous sum? Is that the problem?
Well, I'll let Representative Bellamy deliberate on that. But I mean, it seems to me that the reason why we included that was that if indeed a person acted in bad faith, they should know in advance that one of the penalties will be, in fact, picking up the tab on attorney's fees. And once again, I guess there's an interest on the committee's part to provide enough room so that someone can get out of that if the attorney's fees are extremely high. Is that the intent? Put another way?
If you read all of 6, in the first line it says, in the proceeding under sub 1 of this section, they can already award reasonable attorney's fees. The second sentence is really punishment for acting in bad faith. And I would agree with that. And the reason that when I looked at it again and took out the word all, I think it gives the court some leeway to say, wait a minute here, I'm going to award these attorney's fees, but some of these fees for investigation and stuff were not necessary and were not a part of this case.
Well, at this point, due to the nature of the bill and its complexities, I don't think that striking the word all changes the intent of that particular section to in a dramatic degree, so I would accept it as a friendly amendment.
Okay.
It would read then, if a party is found to have acted in bad faith, that party will pay attorney's fees and costs of the defending party.
Okay. Is that agreeable to folks? Okay. Representative Bellamy, your second amendment?
It won't be in the form of an amendment, it's a form of discussion, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
There is concern from Judge Behrens on sub 8 of page 17.
Sub 8 on that same page.
Right.
Okay.
He believes, and I'm trying to review from my notes, but he believes that it is, and according to the notes on the side of the page, it is already part of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. I think his point was is that this part, he indicates to me it's unconstitutional. But I think his point is being is that these rules have never been tested in the court, and he believes personally that there's some problems with constitutionality dealing with the situation when one person moves out of the state either before or after the divorce is granted. I'm bringing it up for discussion. I do not think it's one of those things you could discuss all day.
Versed in the law, no holding a law degree or a member of the bar, I would request that other members who are members of the bar perhaps could address the potential unconstitutionality of that section. As I read it, it is, in my research indicates it is not, there is not a constitutional problem, but I would
Well, we could always take a recess and look for expert opinion on Constitution.
I already tried, and they can't respond.
Okay. Representative Hanlon.
The way it's written...
Discretion's the better part of constitutional law sometimes. Representative Hanlon?
The way it's written, and the courts talk in terms of what kind of contact or nexus do you have to have with somebody in order, even if they've left the state, in order to assert jurisdiction or power over them. This is obviously written so that if the Domestic Relations Action was involved and the defendant was present in this state and at one time committed to the personal jurisdiction of the Domestic Relations Court in this state, that act in and of itself would grant future jurisdiction for domestic relation purposes. That, as you say, Representative Bellamy, some court at some time might say that's not necessarily, that may not be enough contact. So when they talk about constitutionality, they're talking about whether or not those acts in and of themselves are enough contact to assert the power of the courts of the state of Oregon over that person in later times. I think there are arguments on both sides of it. And that surely it would be constitutional until such time as somebody... I mean, it's not blatantly unconstitutional on its face. Let's put it that way.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dix.
Perhaps I have in my engrossed copy that there was an appeals court decision which says that Oregon courts permanently retain jurisdiction in regard to spousal and child support. Mm-hmm. I can't read the writing.
Carlin. It's Carlin v. Carlin. It's a 1983 Court of Appeals case.
Okay. Ready for my next issue?
Sure.
The next issue is on page 9.
Okay, this is 9 on the bill. Okay.
About two-thirds down down the page.
Okay.
You will find the term commensurate with the present value down on the underlying portion. If you read this part here, you're talking about that up above it says in the underlying portion that if they order support over a period of time, support in lieu of a share of property, they're going to tell the person to provide or maintain life insurance. And if the person dies and the person did not have the life insurance in force, then it says the court shall modify the method of payment of the spousal support. When you get down here, it says in the amount commensurate with the present value. The opinion of the judge was that when you say in the amount commensurate with the present value, that means that he's going to have a legal expert come in and totally assess the value of the estate at both the time of the original award and now, and determine. And he says that could be very expensive and it could take a great deal of time, because no judge is going to say, well, this is the present value commensurate with this delayed time. That was his strong concern in that area.
Okay, my sense is, Representative Bellamy, that if the court feels it has insufficient evidence by which to determine the present value, it's not going to do anything until the moving party or party that's seeking the relief provides that evidence, and the burden would be upon that party to present an expert witness, be it an economist or someone else who's qualified in terms of doing the number crunching to determine the present value of those assets which had been reserved for spousal support.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I guess I would agree with that, but the people involved in this sort of situation, you put yourself in the situation where here you have a spouse who is depending on support. The guy dies. Normally the guy dies. He doesn't have life insurance. takes a while to figure that out when he was supposed to have. Then they go to court for a change, and then the court comes along and says, well, you're right, but now we're going to have an expert evaluate this state. We're talking about a delayed time in getting this financial benefit to somebody who may need it.
I guess, Representative Dix,
not to interrupt, but if I understood you correctly, Representative Springer, that the party bringing that action would, at the time of you bring the action, would have to provide the expert witness in order for the court, the judge, to make that decision. So there'd be no decision, but the judge would never say, you're right, until the action had been taken and that expert witness had been brought forward.
There would
be no delay.
I think if the estate was to, the estate then could probably say, if they didn't agree with the expert witness, which most likely they wouldn't, they would say, I don't agree with that, and we want the court to provide the expert witness. Because they would assume that the one party who's bringing this witness is bringing a prejudicial witness.
Normally the court never calls a witness, or rarely calls a witness. The burden is usually upon the parties in court, one side or the other, to produce evidence or to produce witnesses or testimony.
Now you're beginning, what the judge relayed to me was, with that language, the court would have to, because there's no way that they could rule on what the present value is of the original spousal support when there was supposed to be life insurance. That was the point of the judge.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm delivering this third hand, so it's tough on me to get his exact comments.
Representative Hanlon?
Mr. Chair, I just think that the determination of that, if this ended up being uncontested, would be presented by affidavit and subject to cross-examination, and would be provided by the party or the movement, the party making the affirmative act. I think you're correct that that's not going to be, at least from the language the way I read it, it's not going to be incumbent upon the court to produce an expert in order to get to that present value. That's, in an adversarial system, incumbent upon the parties involved in the court.
Okay. Is there further discussion? Representative Bellamy, that's one for three. I don't know if you felt like you made much progress or had a motion on the other two concepts which you discussed, but I hope that our discussion and our statement has been helpful in terms of addressing at least part of the concerns that you had mentioned. Representative Miller, did you
see additional discussion?
Sure.
Mr. Chair. Representative Dix, on page 7 of the queen size.
Okay, 7?
7, correct. The language dealing with the extent to which present and future earning capacity of a party is impaired due to extended absence from the job market to perform the role of homemaker. What is that?
Well, also,
I guess, why is that the only thing that you've included in that, in the category of extending the special consideration?
Well, and the question of homemaker, to be consistent, I would have to go with Representative Bellamy and allow the judge to decide what constitutes a homemaker. The intent of the bill is to address the issue of those women who have been married for a number of years, who have worked in the home a number of years, and who find themselves in a divorce case in their waning years, having lived as a homemaker with that particular male or female really the better part of their life, and been homemakers. In other words, not holding jobs, not discontinuing their line of work in exchange for keeping a family or keeping up a house.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Miller.
Your sense is they'd have to spend a good deal of time in the house, and I judge by your comments they would have to be women?
No, not necessarily.
Okay, you mentioned that.
I mean, there's no sexual definition, gender definition in the bill. So, If a woman, certainly in this day and age, probably in the past, if a woman was the husband made the decision that she was going to work and he was going to stay at home, then certainly the male could qualify under that.
Further questions, Mr. Chair?
Representative Miller.
Well, I think what by talking about homemakers and then talking about you have to consider what suitable job opportunities are available or unavailable, you're really kind of limiting. I don't know what's available perhaps for someone who's been a homemaker, that whether or not this really works as a further limitation.
Tell me again the line that you were...
Well, right at the end of... these aren't numbered, so
right.
It'd be the sub F, fourth line down. Your earning capacity is impaired due to extended absence performing the role of a homemaker, the extent to which suitable job opportunities are unavailable.
Mm-hmm. And your comment is...
Well, I wonder if that's more limiting than if you were just absent from the job market, like the current language, and then couldn't find suitable job opportunities based on whatever it is you were doing during your absence. Not just limiting this to those who were homemakers and absent from the job market.
Well, my concern, I understand. My concern in addressing the issue in the bill was those individuals who are homemakers, who I don't feel are properly addressed in the present statute.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Dix, I think that's... We've had some discussion that we have some confidence in the courts to figure out what the role of a homemaker is. Maybe we can also have confidence that they figure out if some folks were absent from the job market, that they may indeed deserve some consideration for a longer period of time, and perhaps this bill would even perhaps get them permanent support.
Well, one of the other reasons why we included it is once again the consistency in the different courts. There are some, my understanding is there are some judges who will consider that term and some who won't, all within the same state. There can be case law cited some judges do not find that term adequate in describing someone's role in the household. Others find it more than adequate.
Well, so I would just say, Mr. Chairman, for discussion purposes here, that with some of the language that is in here, suitable job opportunity, extended absences, certain adjectives like that call for a degree of flexibility from the bench that I think is inherent in that language, and to suggest that somehow we're going to get some system that's going to render the same result in every case is one that I don't think we ought to be trying to achieve. I think there is an awful lot to be said for folks taking a case-by-case look at the litigants and the parties before them and making an appropriate decision.
I would agree there's a lot to be said for that.
Thank you.
Okay, is there further discussion?
Go to your room.
Okay. If not, Representative Dix, do we have a motion on the bill as amended?
Yeah, I was wondering if you could round the committee up.
Well, Representative Bond,
the bill has been moved.
Okay.
You have a motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Dix moves 3030 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Bunn is excused for a meeting in the minority leader's office. Would you like us to call him up, Representative Dix?
No, thank you.
Okay. There's no further discussion, question, or comment. The clerk will call the roll.
Thank you.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Dix?
Aye.
Aye.
Miller?
No.
Phillips?
No.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Miller?
Sir, notice of a possible minority report.
Okay. Any volunteers? Representative Dix?
I'd like to hear it.
Okay. there further business to come before the full committee?
Okay, if not, the full committee will be adjourned, and I'd like to have Subcommittee 1 try to begin again at 2:45. Taking short recess until that time.